September 14, 1963, Bowmanville, Ontario. 13-year-old Noreen Greenlee leaves her best friend's house and heads towards a bus stop, but never returns home. Shortly thereafter, one of Noreen's sisters is nearly struck by a car and hears a female scream from inside, and it turns out it matches the description of a vehicle seen near the bus stop minutes earlier. 5 decades later, a tipster comes forward with an allegation that his deceased father confessed to killing Noreen and burying the car containing her body. But an excavation fails to turn up any evidence and no trace of Noreen is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring an unsolved missing persons case from our podcast's host country of Canada, the 1963 disappearance of 13-year-old Noreen Greenlee. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Dagan Cardinal, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Dagan. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for 3 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of this episode. Anyway, today's featured case was requested by Dagan when he originally entered this contest, and I've since received requests to cover this story from other people, including Pat Gard, who happens to be the mother of fellow Canadian true crime podcaster Jack Luna of Dark Topic fame. Noreen Greenlee went missing shortly after leaving her best friend's house to wait for a bus, and one of Noreen's sisters would soon report nearly being hit by a car, and she likely heard Noreen screaming from inside the vehicle while she was in the midst of being abducted. Even though over 5 decades have passed, I think one of the reasons this case has been in such high demand is because of an interesting development which took place 2 years ago, as police performed an excavation to search for a car which had supposedly been buried by Noreen's abductor. Unfortunately, they did not find anything, but Noreen's surviving relatives are continuing to work diligently at keeping her case in the spotlight, so I thought now would be an ideal time to feature it on the podcast. In addition, this episode is also going to be exploring the disappearance of another young Ontario girl, 10-year-old Marianne Schuett, who went missing under similar circumstances less than 3 years later. Like Noreen, Marianne was last seen climbing into a Ford vehicle driven by an unidentified man, but even if these cases are not connected, I feel they're both worthy of exploration on this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the unsolved disappearance of Noreen Greenlee. Our story begins in Ontario in 1963, and our central figure is 13-year-old Noreen Ann Greenlee, who lives at her residence on Holt Road in the community of Maple Grove. Noreen's parents are Harvey and Nadine Greenlee, and she is the third of their 7 children, as she has 4 brothers and 2 sisters. Maple Grove is on the outskirts of Bowmanville, a town located about 75 kilometers east of Toronto, which had a population of around 7,500 people at that time. On Saturday, September the 14th, Noreen boarded the bus and traveled to Bowmanville so she could meet up with her best friend, Bonnie Wilkins, and Bonnie's boyfriend, Gary Woolner. They bowled a few games at a bowling alley called the Liberty Bowl before walking downtown and stopping for a bite to eat at a local establishment called Sam's Restaurant. Afterward, the group headed back to Bonnie's house located on Waverly Road at the intersection of Highway 2. They arrived sometime after 11 p.m., but since Bonnie's parents were out of town, she politely asked Noreen if she could spend some time alone with her boyfriend. Noreen agreed to her request and walked across the street to wait at the bus stop for the bus ride home. Around 10 minutes later, Noreen returned to Bonnie's house, complaining that she had become cold while waiting. Bonnie offered to let Noreen borrow a coat, but she declined to take it and soon left the residence again, as the bus was scheduled to arrive shortly. But sometime within the next few minutes, Noreen would become a missing person. Shortly thereafter, Noreen's 12-year-old sister, Joyce, along with one of her cousins and a friend, were walking near the Greenlee family residence on Holt Road when a blue vehicle appeared. It suddenly swerved towards the three youngsters, and they were forced to dive into the ditch to avoid getting hit. Joyce thought she heard a scream from a young female inside the car before it drove off, so she immediately rushed home and told her family about what happened. This prompted her father Harvey and one of her brothers to go out searching for the vehicle, but they were unable to find it. Anyway, concern grew when Noreen failed to arrive home, so her father phoned Bonnie to find out where she was. When Bonnie told Harvey that Noreen had already left her residence hours earlier, he contacted the Bowmanville Police Department to officially report his daughter missing. The police would soon contact the bus driver, who had been driving the route on Highway 2 during the time period Noreen was last seen. He confirmed having passed the bus stop at the intersection of Highway 2 and Waverly Road at around 11:30 p.m. that night, but said that Noreen was not waiting there. However, one witness who did see Noreen was a man who drove down Waverly Road to drop his mother off and saw a young girl standing at the bus stop sometime between 11 o'clock and 11:15. After he dropped his mother off and drove back towards Highway 2, the witness said he saw this girl climbing into a blue vehicle being driven by an unidentified male wearing a black fedora. The vehicle was described as being a blue 1957 or 1959 Ford Prefect, and disturbingly, it seemed to match the description of the car which nearly hit Joyce on Holt Road minutes later. This meant that the scream Joyce heard likely came from Noreen, who had been abducted by the driver. It was speculated that after seeing her sister walking down the road, Noreen may have grabbed the wheel and caused the car to swerve in order to capture Joyce's attention. Oddly, no mention was ever made of this vehicle during the earliest newspaper coverage of this case, but regardless, police had no success at tracking down a car matching that description in the area. At the time, Noreen had a job at a gas bar, so her family theorized that she may have been abducted by someone who recognized or was familiar with her from there. In the days following her disappearance, a number of search efforts were organized to look for Noreen throughout Bowmanville and the surrounding area, but they failed to turn up any trace of her. In May of 1964, Noreen's parents, along with two Ontario police officers, made a 3,000-kilometer trip west to Calgary, Alberta. A girl from the city of Oshawa, which is located 15 kilometers west of Bowmanville, claimed that she crossed paths with Noreen the previous November. This girl apparently knew Noreen from having ice skated together and said she spoke with her for about 20 minutes at a restaurant in Calgary's Mount Royal section. According to the girl, Noreen had dyed her light brown hair black and told her she was living in an apartment on Carlton Street. Noreen also reportedly said that she was working part-time as a domestic and liked Calgary a lot. The two Ontario police officers worked with the Calgary Police Service to conduct a house-by-house search on Carlton Street and checked all the local welfare, domestic, and employment agencies, but they were unable to find Noreen or any conclusive evidence that she had ever been in the city. Over the years, the Greenlee family would continue to buy Noreen Christmas gifts and celebrate her birthday in hopes that she might return alive someday. Sadly, Harvey Greenlee suffered a brain aneurysm before he passed away in 1968, and his wife Nadine began a descent into alcoholism. By this point, Nadine's three oldest children had moved out of the home, but her three youngest children would be removed by social services because Nadine could no longer take care of them, and they were subsequently separated and placed in foster care. Nadine passed away in 1992, but her children promised her that they would continue the search for Noreen. One of Noreen's brothers, Mark Greenlee, who was only 3 years old when his sister went missing, would say that her disappearance devastated the entire family and stated during an interview, quote, "We are all victims one way or another. It's not even about arresting anyone anymore. If we could give the guy amnesty, we would. We just want to find where she is and properly put her to rest." End quote. The family believed that Noreen's remains were buried somewhere in the Bowmanville area, and Noreen's youngest sister, Shelley, who passed away of cancer in 2017, once stated, quote, "There isn't a day I drive by Bowmanville, and I don't wonder if I'm driving over her. Whoever the coward is, have the decency to man up and give us the remains. Phone in anonymously and give us the remains so we can bury her with my mom and dad." End quote. Noreen's surviving relatives have worked diligently to keep her case in the spotlight, particularly her niece, Kelly Greenlee, who was not even born until 4 years after Noreen went missing. According to Kelly, her late mother once received a phone call from an anonymous male who mentioned Noreen and said he had something he needed to get off his chest, but then he abruptly hung up. In May of 2015, over 100 people participated in a walk to remember Noreen, which would retrace her final route before she disappeared, beginning at the former site of the Liberty Bowl, before proceeding to the former site of Sam's Restaurant in downtown Bowmanville. Afterward, they headed towards Bonnie Wilkins' former home, before ending the walk at the location where the old bus stop on Highway 2 once stood. They did this while carrying a banner which read, "Bring Noreen Home," and after attending the walk, forensic artist Diana Trepkoff drew up a new age-enhanced composite sketch which showed what Noreen might look like at age 65. By 2016, the Durham Regional Police's homicide unit was handling Noreen's disappearance, and shortly after seeing Kelly Greenlee interviewed in a local cable television segment about the case, a man contacted her with a tip. He claimed that his deceased father was a construction worker who had also worked part-time as a bus driver in Bowmanville at the time Noreen went missing. The story goes that this man had allegedly confessed to pulling over at the bus stop to offer Noreen a ride, but shortly after picking her up, he killed Noreen by striking her with a dowel and put her body inside his car trunk. At the time, he was working on a construction project which involved rerouting Highway 57 near Concession Road 8, so 2 days after the crime, he drove to the site and told his co-workers that he wanted to get rid of a car which had been causing him a lot of trouble. He then proceeded to use a backhoe to bury the vehicle in a large hole in the ground while Noreen's body was still inside the trunk. Interestingly enough, the tipster said his father drove a Ford Prefect, the same type of car which was spotted on the night Noreen disappeared. This man's name has never been released publicly, but it sounds like some details about his son's story did check out, as he had worked as a bus driver in Bowmanville, and there was a construction project involving the rezoning of Highway 57 in 1963. Kelly contacted the Cold Case Society at Western University, who would bring in a team of experts, including a forensic anthropologist named Renee Wilmon, to perform a geophysical survey. The car had supposedly been buried on a piece of property located in a rural area just north of Bowmanville, so this team would perform a search using a magnetometer. They eventually found a spot where they detected some magnetic anomalies which seemingly pointed towards an unusual object being buried underground. These findings were presented to the Durham Regional Police, and Renee Wilmon recommended that they use ground-penetrating radar to investigate this spot before they attempted a dig. The police had always been skeptical about the credibility of the tipster's story, but they ultimately decided to perform an excavation of the property, though they would ignore the recommendation to use ground-penetrating radar beforehand. In October of 2018, an excavator was used to dig two trenches at the location, one of which was 150 feet long and the other 100 feet long, and they were both 7 feet deep. They then walked through the trenches with metal detectors, which would be able to detect anomalies that were buried as much as 3 feet below them. But in the end, they were unable to pick up any sign of a buried vehicle or any other corroborating evidence to suggest that Noreen was there. Renee Wilmon was not invited by police to participate in the excavation and took issue with how it was carried out, believing that it was not as extensive as it could have been. After watching some news footage, Wilmon concluded that the excavation did not quite line up with the area where the anomalies had been detected. She suspected the police may have dug in the wrong spot, but in spite of this, no further excavations have been performed on the property. While many of the original news reports stated that the tipster's father had made a deathbed confession to Noreen's murder, Durham Police Detective Sergeant Mitch Martin made this clarification to City News Toronto. Quote, "We've spoke with the gentleman, and his father did not confess to this on his deathbed. He does believe his father buried a car, but he does not believe that his father murdered Noreen." End quote. Once again, the investigation has reached a standstill, but Noreen's relatives still continue to spread the word about her case and maintain a website and Facebook page devoted to her. A Canadian Missing Children's database also contains this quote on Noreen's profile page from her niece. Quote, "Noreen, your parents, brothers, and sisters all sought closure to find you. Unfortunately, their journey in life here ended before that closure came. We are still here for you, Auntie Noreen. We must never forget about our missing children. We must keep them alive. We are their voice. We, together, can make a difference and bring our missing children home." End quote. But unfortunately, after 57 years, the disappearance of Noreen Greenlee continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, whenever I cover two different cold cases on an episode of the podcast, I normally discuss each case individually and provide separate analysis. But here, the circumstances between our two featured cases are so similar that before I discuss Noreen's case any further, I'm going to dive right into the disappearance of Marianne Schuett. Like I mentioned in the intro, this girl went missing only 2.5 years after Noreen vanished, and a presumed abduction took place around 150 kilometers southwest of Bowmanville. At the time, Marianne Schuett was 10 years old and living in Kilbride, a small village located in a rural section of Burlington. She was a fourth grade student at Kilbride Public School, and at around 4 p.m. on the afternoon of April the 27th, 1967, Marianne left the school to walk home, where she lived with her parents, Milton and Ethel Schuett, and two brothers. Marianne ordinarily made this walk with one of her male classmates, but since the boy had recently received a new bike, she would be walking by herself on this particular day. Even though Marianne's residence was located 400 yards away, and the walk should have only taken 5 minutes, she never arrived, and it wasn't long before her mother contacted the Halton Regional Police Service to report her missing. Well, two workers from a nearby American Motors plant soon reported that they had been driving past Kilbride Public School that afternoon and saw a girl matching Marianne's description speaking to a man through the driver's side window of a vehicle parked near the school driveway. As they were driving away, one of the witnesses looked in his rearview mirror and saw the girl climbing into the car, which subsequently drove away and passed Marianne's home. The vehicle was described as being a dark blue or black Ford Renault station wagon, and a composite sketch was circulated of the unidentified driver, a thin-faced man in his 40s, wearing round, wire-rimmed glasses and a canvas fedora. This led to one of the largest search efforts in Canadian history, as around 18,000 civilian volunteers joined law enforcement in their attempts to find Marianne. While no trace of Marianne herself was found, the search would turn up a blue sneaker alongside Highway 25 at a spot about 14 miles from Marianne's home, and it matched the size and the description of the shoes she had been wearing. At one point, Milton Schuett stated that he would sell his home and pay a sizable reward with no questions asked if anyone returned his daughter. Both Milton and his wife Ethel would later send out a public appeal to her abductor in Maclean's magazine, which read, quote, "We beg you with all our heart to phone or write us a few words to tell us where she is. It is too terrible not knowing. Her brothers can't go on not knowing where she is, and our hearts are breaking. We have to know. Please be merciful and let our prayers be answered." End quote. Mary Ann's disappearance devastated the Shewitt family as they eventually moved away and Milton and Ethel wound up getting divorced. While Milton has since passed away, an article published about the case in May of last year stated that Ethel is still alive. In 1976, Canadian rock and roll musician Ian Thomas, who happens to be the brother of Dave Thomas of SCTV and Strange Brew fame, released a song titled Mary Jane. It tells the story of a young girl named Mary Jane who vanished after climbing into a car, and Thomas has confirmed that the song was inspired by Mary Ann Shewitt's disappearance. The case pretty much faded from the spotlight for 2 decades until a number of surprising developments took place. In December of 1989, a woman from the town of Ancaster went to the police and accused a man of having repeatedly sexually assaulted her over a 7-year period when she was a young girl during the 1970s. This would soon prompt another Ancaster woman to come forward and accuse this man of the exact same thing. It turned out the man in question had already been arrested in 1972 after he attempted to abduct a 17-year-old Burlington girl in his vehicle before she managed to get away from him and run to a nearby house for help. He was initially charged with kidnapping, forcible seizure, and assault causing bodily harm, but these charges would be reduced, and the man pled guilty to the lesser charge of common assault, for which he received a sentence of 30 days in jail and 2 years probation. Well, a thorough investigation into this man's background revealed that he had lived in Burlington with his wife and children at the time Mary Ann went missing, and he also bore a resemblance to the composite sketch of the unidentified driver of the Renault station wagon. But it also turned out that a potentially crucial lead had been overlooked during the original investigation. 2 days after Mary Ann originally vanished, an eyewitness told police that he saw a nervous-looking man cleaning out a vehicle and wiping it with a cloth at an empty picnic area located about 20 kilometers from Kilbride. Even though the description of the male driver seen with Mary Ann had not yet been released publicly by this point, this eyewitness's description of the nervous-looking man in the picnic area matched him. He also described the vehicle as being a dark blue Renault station wagon, and he even managed to get the license plate number. However, for reasons unknown, this lead was completely ignored at the time, but a new check on the license number matched it to a Renault, which had once been owned by the same man who was now being accused of sexual assault. He had originally purchased the vehicle only 3 days before Mary Ann went missing, and while he wore distinctive-looking wire-rimmed glasses in 1967, he apparently stopped wearing them for a time after Mary Ann's disappearance. Even though the eyewitness from the picnic area was now in his 90s, police brought him in to look at a photo lineup, and he wound up picking this man out. By this point, the suspect was living in Hamilton, and while he was questioned by investigators about both Mary Ann's case and the sexual assaults, they had not yet built up enough evidence to make an arrest. In January of 1991, the investigation came to an abrupt halt when this person of interest decided to kill himself. Even though he left behind a suicide note, it did not make any reference to Mary Ann. However, Detective Sergeant Graham Barnes of the Halton Regional Police would publicly state, quote, "There's absolutely no doubt in any of our minds that he's the person responsible, that he abducted and murdered Mary Ann Shewitt," end quote. So it sounds like this is one of these missing persons cases, which is pretty much considered to be solved, but the victim's body has never been found. If this man was Mary Ann's abductor, and he decided to take his own life without revealing what he did to her, then this is a major tragedy for her family, and there's really not much else that can be done. But I suppose the big unanswered question might be, could this same man have been responsible for abducting Noreen Greenlee? Well, I'm sure it might be tempting to think that, when you consider the similarities. Both abductions took place 2.5 years and approximately 150 kilometers apart, and in each case, the apparent perpetrator was a man wearing a fedora driving a Ford brand vehicle. Even though a Ford Prefect and a Renault station wagon are cars which do have resemblances to each other, I think you can rule out the possibility of the same vehicle being used in both crimes, since the authorities have a very promising person of interest in Marianne's case, and records show that he purchased his Renault only 3 days before she went missing. But let's not forget that it's been alleged that the vehicle used to abduct Noreen was buried shortly after her disappearance, so who's to say that the same man couldn't have purchased another Ford later on? However, the authorities have never given any indication that they believe the same person committed both crimes. They seem to have a lot of information on Marianne's alleged abductor, as he was arrested for attempting to abduct another girl during the 1970s, and was accused by at least two others of sexual assault. Given how extensively he must have been investigated, if police found anything at all to link him to Noreen's case, or even place him in the Bowmanville area in 1963, they've never said so. This person of interest's name has never been released publicly, and you can understand why, because he was married and had children when these crimes took place, and without conclusive evidence which proves his guilt, such as DNA testing, it would be unfair for his family to face a potential backlash. Of course, given that this man was also being investigated for other sexual assaults at the time of his suicide, that may have influenced his decision, even if he had nothing to do with Marianne's disappearance. All that being said, with the information we have, there is a really compelling case for him being Marianne's abductor, as he drove a Ford Renault at the time of her disappearance, matched the description of the driver seen talking to her, and was seen cleaning a Renault in a picnic area 2 days after she went missing. An eyewitness also took down his license number, and it turned out to be a perfect match, but it must be pointed out that the license number was only taken at the picnic area, not the actual scene where Marianne was abducted. Technically, this eyewitness account only proves he was cleaning his car, so you can understand why they decided not to make an arrest, but I have no idea why this tip was not followed up on back in 1967. If they had been able to put two and two together, this man might have been investigated much earlier. Not only would this have helped Marianne's case get solved relatively quickly, but the other alleged attacks this man made on other girls during the 1970s could have been prevented. Anyway, I'm going to continue on with the presumption that Noreen and Marianne's abductions were two different crimes carried out by two different perpetrators. However, one similarity between these two cases is that both girls were victims of unfortunate twists of fate. Marianne ordinarily would have been walking home with a classmate, but he was not there that day because he recently received a new bike, and Noreen may have stayed longer at her friend Bonnie's house if Bonnie had not wanted to spend some time alone with her new boyfriend. So when Noreen went to wait for the 11:30 bus alone, she could have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Of course, what adds an extra element of tragedy to this story is that Noreen's abductor may have driven right past her house while she was being held captive and nearly ran her sister Joyce off the road. It's been theorized that Noreen might have seen Joyce and grabbed the wheel in an attempt to get her attention, because when the driver passed by her house and did not stop, this may have been when Noreen first realized that something was wrong. It's chilling to think that Joyce likely heard Noreen screaming as they drove by, but was unaware at this point that it was her own sister in distress. And it's also heartbreaking how Noreen's father and brother attempted to search for the vehicle before they had any real idea about what happened to her. It's been suspected that the man and the prefect pulled up to the bus stop and offered Noreen a ride home, and that she may have known him or at least recognized him, because otherwise, she might not have climbed into a vehicle with a stranger. At the time, she was working a job at a gas bar, so the driver could have been someone who recognized her from there. And as we're going to talk about momentarily, the man who has been accused of confessing to Noreen's murder was a bus driver in Bowmanville at that time, so perhaps this is how she knew him. The other major lead which was followed up on back then was the alleged sighting of Noreen in Calgary in the months following her disappearance. As you recall, a girl who knew Noreen claimed that she conversed with her in a restaurant, and by this point, Noreen had dyed her hair black and said she was working as a domestic and living in an apartment in the area. Well, the obvious problem with this sighting is that Noreen was still only 13 years old at this time. How exactly could she have traveled to Calgary and gotten a job and an apartment at that age? Yes, theoretically, if Noreen was abducted and held captive, her kidnapper could have taken her there, but why would he be allowing her to go out alone and have 20-minute conversations with other people at a public place like a restaurant? Obviously, I don't know the full details of their conversation, but this girl apparently claimed that Noreen told her she liked living in Calgary, and it doesn't sound like she gave off any indication that she was under duress. If there was any evidence to suggest that Noreen ran away of her own volition, then perhaps this sighting might make more sense, but she was clearly taken against her will. I don't know if this witness made up her story, or just mistook another girl for Noreen, but I'm pretty sure she was never in Calgary. Sadly, it seems like Noreen's surviving relatives concur that the most likely explanation is that she was murdered shortly after she was abducted, and her remains might still be in the Bowmanville area, but now we have to explore this alleged confession about her being buried inside a car trunk. Now, there's been some confusion about this whole situation, as the Durham Regional Police has since told the media that the tipster's father did not actually confess on his deathbed, though he still believes his father buried a car at some point. The excavation to find the buried car was performed only 2 years ago, and since I had already received some requests to cover Noreen's case on the podcast before this took place, I followed the media coverage of the excavation pretty closely. While it was disappointing that nothing was found, there's been some question about whether this dig was as thorough as it could have been. The police were initially reluctant to go through with it because they were skeptical about the tipster's credibility, and I can see where they're coming from. The story goes that the perpetrator decided to bury the car at a construction project involving the rezoning of Highway 57, and it is true that a project like this actually took place around the time Noreen went missing. But I'm trying to imagine how these events would have played out. This guy apparently used a backhoe to bury the car at the construction site in full view of his co-workers and told them that since the vehicle was giving him a lot of trouble, he wanted to get rid of it. While I admittedly have never worked at a construction site, would everyone there really be that cool with someone using the company equipment to bury their own personal property, especially something as large as a car? When you consider the fact that Noreen's body was supposedly in the trunk while this was going on, that seems incredibly brazen. Since Noreen's disappearance was a pretty big story in Bowmanville at that time, shouldn't the sight of someone burying an entire vehicle have raised more eyebrows? About 2 years passed between when this tip came in and the Durham Regional Police performed the excavation, so I have to wonder how much additional investigating they did to corroborate this story. Was there anyone from that construction crew who was still alive and could confirm witnessing the burial of the car? It just seems so much easier to dispose of a body individually rather than make such a public spectacle of yourself like that. But on the other hand, I can understand the perpetrator's reasoning for wanting to get rid of both the body and the car. Due to the incident where the vehicle swerved off the road and nearly ran down Joyce, I'm sure he was well aware that the authorities had a description. Even though investigators searched for a blue Ford Prefect, they could not find one, and while that might be due to the fact that the abductor was not from the area and was just passing through Bowmanville, the entire vehicle literally being buried in the ground could also provide a potential explanation for why they never found it. In addition, the prefect was not mentioned in the earliest newspaper coverage of the case, so that could account for why the construction crew did not pick up on its significance. There's been some controversy about whether or not the Durham Regional Police's excavation of this property was thorough enough, or if they even dug in the correct spot where the magnetic anomalies were detected. This is why some people believe that the car might still be buried somewhere at that location. It would be nice if the police could do a more thorough excavation to be 100% certain, but it's been nearly 2 years now, so they may have their own reasons for not proceeding any further. But even if this whole thing was a false lead, it at least helped put a 55-year-old cold case back into the spotlight again, and maybe it will eventually pave the way to finding a resolution someday. All we know for certain is that the disappearances of Noreen Greenlee and Marianne Schuett wound up devastating their respective communities and families, but they still have surviving relatives who want conclusive answers, and to bring these missing girls back home to give them proper burials. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearances of Noreen or Marianne, please contact the Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. Anyway, another special thanks to Dagan Cardinal for narrating the opening of this episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you're automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter, and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about an unsolved mystery from the life of the most famous mystery writer of all time, Agatha Christie, who went missing in 1926 before she resurfaced 11 days later, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of how and why she disappeared. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listener who has signed up with us on Patreon this week, Celestine C. So thank you very much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.